Well, just last night I got back into Jackson for the past few days. As I said at last Sunday's Mass, I was with our Lumen Christi High School students, about 70 of them, for the past couple days down in Washington, D.C., for the March for Life. They, I believe, just got back on the bus. They must have got back into Jackson, I think, about now or within the last hour, so I'm sure they're all pooped out. They're going home to go to bed. I took the bus down with them and slept zero on the bus ride down to D.C., so it's been a little bit of a whirlwind for the past few days. We got back in last night. Several of us flew back so that, well, to make sure that we got back for Mass, you know, on Sunday and all. And I got back into the rectory last night and said, I should pray. I should pray before going to bed. So we have our little chapel room upstairs in the rectory, and I walked upstairs, sat down in one of the chairs in the chapel room, and within about 10 minutes, I was on the floor laying down instead, and promptly fell asleep for the next hour, and then woke up and said, I gotta go to bed. So, needless to say, thanks be to God, I'm awake at 8 o'clock for Mass. I could still be sleeping right now, but here we are. So, God was really good to us on the trip. We had a really good group of kids that went with us. And the March for Life is it's really powerful. It's a really, for those of us who have been to D.C. for that march, it's a pretty significant witness. And if you've never been, it's worth to at least see some of the pictures and the clips. Every year they make this time-lapse video of the march that goes down along the Washington Mall up towards the National Capitol. And it's amazing to see what kind of numbers are gathered for that march for the cause of life. I was thinking about this before Mass, and I think I'll share this story with you to give you some context. Just good for us to be reminded of how purposeful life is and how significant it is to be known by Jesus and to be called by Jesus. And this is a story from my own family history, actually. And it's actually kind of a sober story, but one with great weight and great significance for me. And it's a story that I learned from my mom and my dad that I didn't know about until a little bit later on in life. I think I must have been a teenager, and it's a story of my past. We unfortunately live in an age today, since about the year 1999, when we hear tragic news on a kind of consistent basis these days about tragedies that happen in school settings. Now, my high school students know this story. I told this story to them at their school Mass earlier this week. And beginning in 1999 with a shooting in Columbine, I think that was the year, it was either then or 2000, horrible, horrible tragedy. And since then, it's been perpetuated on several occasions where we mourn as a nation over very terrible instances of young men, principally, who are in just very dark places and believe that violence is the only answer to their life's problems. And so since then, you have things like Sandy Hook and Virginia Tech and Parkland. And those are terrible tragedies. It's a little bit less well known that the worst school tragedy in the United States history actually didn't happen in the last 20 years. It happened in 1927 in Bath, Michigan, called the Bath School Disaster. And in 1927, almost 40 children died in a school massacre, and another almost 60 children were injured in that massacre as a result of a man of that town in Bath, Michigan, who was extraordinarily disgruntled and perhaps mentally ill. And he had been down and out in his life and had received notice of foreclosure on his home. He lost a local election, was very upset as the treasurer of the school board that taxes were being raised for a new school building that he didn't agree with. And for whatever reason, he just thought that he was going to get revenge. And so for months, he plotted a school massacre on the brand new school building that had been built for the 300 or so students of the Bath School District that was recently consolidated. He actually had a surplus of dynamite from World War I that he bought from the U.S. government, and he planted that dynamite over months under the foundations of the entire school building. He decided that he was going to blow up the school. And on May 18th, 1927, he actually did so. He preceded that by torching his own house and his fields and killing his family, and then went down on a timer and detonated a dynamite to the school. Half of the school blew up that day, and 38 children died. Several teachers died as well. He ended up going to the scene afterwards with TNT loaded in his own truck and walked out onto the scene where people were trying to help and took a shotgun, blew up his truck, blew up himself and several more adults that were on the scene. Horrible, horrible tragedy. Almost 100, over 100 people were directly affected, either injured or died that day. Now, there was some silver lining because, as a matter of fact, he incorrectly wired some of that dynamite, and so only one wing of the school collapsed. The other half of the school didn't actually detonate, so many lives were saved that day that should have ended but didn't. Now, what's significant about that in my own family history was one of the girls that went to that school, her name was Caroline. She was 9 or 10 years old. On that day, she survived that bombing. She didn't go to school that day because she was sick. Caroline was my great-grandma. She herself was adopted. But she walked away from that tragedy because of a cold or a flu that kept her home. And because, at least on that date, one life was spared, years later, my grandma would be born, and her siblings. And years later, my dad would be born, and his siblings. And years later, I would be born, and my siblings. If my great-grandma didn't have the flu that day, I would never be standing here because I never would have existed. In an indirect way, I would have been an unknown, we'll say, victim of that tragedy that happened 60 years before I was born. And so it's really significant for us to think and to consider, is it worth even one life living? Does it make a difference? Is it just a generic issue, the meaning of one human life? You see, it's as personal as it gets. It affects every single one of us. Because we just can't possibly understand what kind of difference and what kind of meaning our life has in human history. And what kind of effect our life has, not only in the moment, but what effect our life has long after we've left this earth. I thank God that he saved my great-grandma that day, before I was a twinkle in anybody's eye. Because my life is significant too. And your life is significant too. And her life was significant. And just because amongst the many who did lose their lives, those who didn't went on to have, right, a profound effect generations beyond them as well. And so I feel very grateful. I thank God that I know that story about my family, because it gives me a very personal perspective on what it means for us to know the preciousness and the value of human life. Jesus knew that. And Jesus, in his own life, called forth followers to be with him And don't you think that in that following of Jesus, they too would have begun to see in a different way what difference a single choice could make, what difference a single life would make? And they undoubtedly would have seen that, what difference the one life of Jesus made to all the people around them. And that what Jesus revealed to them is, you as my followers, what difference will your life make? We get inklings of what difference our life makes, but we can't even possibly fathom the full story. We don't get that view. When Jesus called Peter and Andrew that day, when he called James and John that day to let down their nets, how significant was that action of dropping a net? They couldn't possibly have known what difference that was going to make, but what a difference it made. It made a world of difference for you and for me. Because they dropped a net, 2,000 years later, here we sit in a church. Because they were invited and in a mysterious way accepted the mission that they couldn't even know in that moment that they were receiving, God has done great things. And God does great things through every human life. No one is excluded from that. You and me, right? This is what we just talked about last week, right? In the baptism of the water, in the baptism of the Spirit, the singular mission that every single one of us has, that nobody else can complete, that we are irreplaceable, every one of us. And in our day and age, right, this is no different. It's no different that we walk in a world desperately desiring to know that people's lives are meaningful. People desperately needing to hear that their life has value. As I said even last week, right, as we see that more and more in our own life, as we come to understand the sheer grace of existing, the sheer goodness of God that we're here, how else can we respond? How else can we see the world around us? I'm not allowed to think, I can't possibly think that life isn't valuable, knowing the value of my own, knowing how my own life 60 years before it was born literally hung on a thread. So in this Sunday, you know, when we hear the story of the beginning of Jesus' ministry, and the Gospels tell us how he goes forth and looks individual people in the eye, and he says, you come follow me. You come follow me. The weight of that invitation, right? We can't possibly fathom how meaningful that is and what effect that will have. What decision, what difference it makes for us every day in large ways and in small ways to drop the net and say, Jesus, I will follow you today. I'll make that decision today. My choices are not insignificant today, even if nobody sees them, even if world history will never record it. It makes a difference. Everything makes a difference because everything is completely meaningful. Jesus asks you today, will you follow me?